Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello all, Annie Mack here reporting from a half-term holiday. It's Friday and this week's episode is called On Air. On Air is obviously a radio term, and it's specifically about radio. It's about voices riding radio waves, travelling through the air at the speed of light. It's about the magic and the wonder of the format that is radio, a format I am obsessed with and in love with and has kind of defined my life. It's about specifically 2 years of my life, from 2002 to 2004, when my radio dream was realised and I got a job as a broadcast assistant at BBC Radio 1. And it all began in a room in a building called Yalding House that we used to call the Dark Side.
When you came into the old entrance at Yalding House, there was one side of the main entrance was the sort of special, was the daytime office, and the other side, G1, was the dark side, which was the specialist office, which I kind of ran the specialist department at Radio 1. So we had Steve Lamacq, John Peel,
Fabio and Groove
Rider, Annie Nightingale, all the dance
lot,
Giles Peterson.
The Dream Team.
The Dream Team.
I used to do keepy-uppies with them in the office.
And there was a fantastic atmosphere in that office because it was pre-social media then. It was the early noughties, wasn't it? And I just remember the kind of raves we used to have on a Friday afternoon, techno and drum and bass offs, didn't we?
Yeah.
Where someone would start, we'll put a techno record on. We all had speakers on our desk then. So if someone would start with a techno record about 3 o'clock on a Friday, and then someone from the other side of the office would drop a drum and bass record, and then it'd be a hard house gabba record. And it was just a lot of fun. It was a real, it felt like a club, you know, because we were all, it felt everyone that was there in that specialist department was in Radio 1 because they love music, and that was the main driving force for us being there. And it was just a fantastic atmosphere because it was a group of like-minded people. You know, and we used to work hard, and we used to party hard, didn't we?
I learned a lot.
I'm sure you did.
In both respects.
That was Rhys Hughes, the man who gave me the golden ticket to work at Radio 1. He was in charge of all the specialist radio shows. What a job, and what a time. Can you imagine what it was like to enter that room as a wide-eyed 24-year-old who had always wanted to work in radio? Giles Peterson, Steve Lamacq, Annie Nightingale, Marianne Hobbs, The Dream Team, Pete Tong, Judge Jules, and of course, John Peel. I am talking to you on Friday, 24th of October. This today is the 15th anniversary of the death of John Peel. And he was and is one of the most original and treasured radio DJs in the world, a total inspiration. I will never forget where I was when I was rang and told of the news of his death. I was in Argos in Brixton with my mum, who started crying. It was really hard to believe. He was such a kind of vital and huge presence in that office, in that place. He represents to me the human connection, the part of radio that I love the most. A voice, a trusted voice and companion talking through the air directly to you, one person listening, and advising you, guiding you, enlightening you to music and sounds and helping you go down this path of discovery. John Peel for me is the kind of essence of music radio, and I am, as so many other people are, so grateful for his existence. At the time when I was this kind of new girl in the office, you know, he was the one that I was most like in awe of, obviously. He was very much there every day. You know, he had a show every night. He used to have a nap in the studio every day. He used to put a newspaper over his head and put his feet up on the table and have a sleep. And the whole office staff kind of deferred to that and were really quiet and put their headphones on. But the rest of the time, it was beautiful chaos. You know, there was sound clashes all the time. It was loud, it was Larry. You'd be tripping over vinyl and mini discs, cassette tapes. And John was kind of like this alternative music Santa Claus. He used to gather up all the music that he got sent in these big mail sacks, and he used to kind of put them over his shoulder and, or drag them out of the room and put them in the boot of his car and drive them back to his house in the countryside. He was so kind to me when I started the show. So kind. I got the show in July 2004. It was called The Mashup, and it started at 9 p.m. on Thursday nights, and John Peel was on after me, and he was always there, kind of commenting and you know, on my show at the start of his show with his bottle of red wine. And I really treasure the fact that I was able to be on air alongside him for a short period of my life. So I've had 15 years on the radio since my show started, and 15 years as a DJ, DJing around the world. I've kind of launched my company AMP, and that's still going. And yeah, my career's evolved, as careers do. But that time between 2002 and 2004 was such a golden time. It feels like zoomed in for me in terms of my memories are so vivid. So before I got my show, I worked as a broadcast assistant on what was then called the Evening Session. The presenter that I worked for first was Steve Lamacq. Then there was Colin Murray in a kind of 6 month interim period before Zane Lowe arrived on the station. And Zane Lowe was highly anticipated. Radio 1 had tried to get him off XFM. They didn't want him to go. They didn't let him go. There was a kind of awkward time, and that's when Colin Murray filled in. But I was on that show, so I was lucky enough to be part of the team that launched Zane's show when he joined Radio 1. And it was a really transformative time for me. He was a huge inspiration in terms of how he approached the radio desk as if it was a musical instrument. And also just this energy that he brought to the show. He had this kind of wild and quite unpredictable energy that he came with every single night. And his kind of musicality in the way that he broadcast his shows, in the way that he spoke over and under and kind of wove his words throughout the music. So it was 1 year of my life that I worked on his show, but it exposed me to the inner workings of what I believe was the world's best music radio show at the time. And it was the year also significantly when I finally managed to realise my ambition to become a radio DJ and became the host of The Mashup, Annie Mac's Mashup. What a name. So I was so happy for this episode to reminisce about that golden time with Zane Lowe. When he came over to London, I got an hour with him. And, you know, this is a guy who has lit up an entire generation of kids' evenings on Radio 1. And also, after 12 years, now moved to Los Angeles and set up Beats One, the radio station affiliated with Apple Music, and is the global creative director of Apple Music. You know, his career has really evolved, and I wanted to speak to him about that, about, you know, his decisions that he's made throughout his life. And also just kind of zoom in on that time where our careers kind of conjoined for that year in 2003. So we sat down, we reminisced, we laughed, and it was such an enjoyable conversation. Let's kick it off. Zane Lowe, enter the podcast. Zane, thank you for being here.
Of course. It's good to see you.
Really good to see you. I wanted to chat to you about the most specifically about that kind of year when our careers were conjoined. Mm-hmm. I thought it was 2 years, but in fact it's only one.
Are you talking about the first 2 years we were together, or when you started to broadcast?
Well, kind of that whole journey.
It's going to be a quick conversation. There's not a lot of memory.
Can you remember stuff? Well, I spoke to our mutual friend Joe this morning, and he's given me some amazing ones. But let's start with that kind of interim period, mm-hmm, after you were on XFM and before you joined Radio 1. Ugh. So was that a 6 month period?
I think it was, six, seven, 8 months, something like that. It felt like much longer than that.
And you weren't allowed work then? It was a gardening leave?
No, it was weird. It's just a weird thing. Like, They meant well, you know, they wanted me to stay. And I didn't, you know, and it wasn't that I didn't want to stay. I just knew I had an opportunity. I wanted to take the opportunity. I wanted to go. And it just very quickly went from being flattering to just annoying to like potentially, you know, destroying the opportunity. Mm. I mean, I remember there was a pretty sobering conversation that Francis, who you know, who was representing me at the time, had with someone at Radio 1 at the BBC where they said, look, you know, we want to keep this position open, but if you can't come to a solution, at some point we're going to have to give it to somebody else. And that was really like, wow, this is going to go south. And so in the end, you know, we had to do whatever it took, and whatever it took was cut a check.
Yeah.
And that's what it was. Yeah. But I'm glad I did it, and I don't regret it. And, you know, if anyone's listening to this and you get yourself in a situation where for one reason or another you're contractually stuck, what you really want to do is find a way for it to end, anything to end well.
Yeah.
You know? And it just meant when I left XFM, which had been a great time for me, I had bad vibes.
Yeah. That's not a nice way to
end. And it took me a long time actually to end up kind of getting past that. But
How long were you at X?
Oh, man, about 3 years, I think.
I should know this, but yeah.
No, about 3 years.
3 years.
Yeah.
And so when you were leaving X, you had, how many years kind of radio DJing experience had you had?
3 years.
That was it. Yeah. You'd done TV, you'd done production before.
Yeah, making beats and all that stuff. I wasn't really DJing out at that point. I had no real radio experience. You know, for me, it was kind of supplementary income. I was just looking for a shot to like get a second job because... you know, I just felt like that would complement the MTV gig pretty nicely. Mm. One was sort of more daytime. I thought I'll do some night shifts in the nighttime and, you know, sweet as. And so, you know, I was trying to reach out to Andrew Phillips and get hold of him. But before I even had the chance, he actually reached out to me because his son had told Andrew to look me up. So that's how
Andrew
it began.
Andrew Phillips being the guy who ran XFM.
XFM. And so that was it. And so he said, I'll try you on overnights and eventually we'll see if we can find you a slot. And I didn't stay on overnights very long, so that's how I knew that perhaps I was, you know, I had some kind of natural inclination towards that stuff.
And did you have the natural kind of personal urge?
Yeah, I loved it. As soon as I went on the air, the performance side of my personality connected to it.
Yeah.
And I recognized that it gave me the spontaneity, that sense of excitement I used to get when I used to go on, I say stages, but that primarily very small 14-inch stages and tiny bars in Auckland, you know, with my rap group and stuff. I got that same sense of excitement going on the radio that you don't get in TV, even live TV. There's so many cooks in the kitchen and so many things that have to be done before one shot or one show gets done. Mm. It's really long. It's more like making an album, but it's the radio thing was like just doing a gig was cool.
Immediate, live. Straight up, even though there's no one in the room apart from your production team.
I kind of dug that.
Which you didn't have XFM, right?
No, I didn't. Not until I started my show, and even then it was just one guy. Mm. Who ended up becoming the program, the person who scheduled the music, which worked beautifully for me.
Yeah, because you got to play good stuff.
I got to play whatever I want. I got more free play, right? Mm. Which is what I really wanted. I would have taken that over the check. So, you know, for me, I loved it straight away and I knew that this was going to be something I would do.
Meanwhile, over at Radio 1, Colin Murray is filling in for you.
During that interim time,
That kind of 6-7 month slot. Uh-huh. I am being the assistant producer or broadcast assistant on his show then. And I remember the feeling of anticipation for you arriving and the team assembling for you and it feeling really, really exciting. And probably like really exciting as it was, but the weight just made it even more like, whoa.
I know. I wish I designed it that way, but I didn't. I was just sitting in Kentish Town stewing.
Yeah, freaking out.
Freaking out.
So when you arrived at Radio 1, was that something that you'd always wanted to do, or was that an opportunity that came up that you're like, yeah, okay, we'll go for the national? Like,
I'm a bit naive in that department. Like, you know, if I'm gonna visualize or I'm gonna attempt to achieve something, it was always more, at that point at least, it was very much in the making music space. When I was at XFM, I was happy. And we were making a racket. Like for a very small radio station, we were, you know, we were riding that wave of Deftones and Limp Bizkit and The Strokes and all this sort of stuff. And we were the station that played that round the clock. Mm. And that stuff was connecting. Mm. So, I mean, I hate to say it, but the general feeling at XFM was, we're winning, which is kind of ludicrous to think now because it's a London-based small alternative station. Still impactful, but you know what I mean? We were proud of what we were doing and we felt like Radio 1 was like not moving the needle at all.
Yeah.
And so when I was asked to actually take the Radio 1 job, which took two pilots, I was very upset at having to do the second one. Oof. Very upset. I was just like, are you, can you swear on this thing?
Yeah, of
course.
Are
you fucking kidding me? But anyway, I did it. And then when they offered me the job, I remember saying to my manager again, like, I don't know, man. I don't know. Yeah. Like, and there was a few people in the industry, some of which you will know, who suggested I don't take it.
Yeah.
Because they felt like Radio 1 was not, like I said, was not really connecting to that particular audience very well.
Yeah.
And, you know, my manager rightly said, that's why they want you. And and he's the one who said, look, why would you stay at a place that where you're kind of peaking right now? Why wouldn't you
There's nowhere to go.
Start a revolution somewhere else. And then and then you'll get your era. You'll get, and you say that in America, they go, era?
Then you get your era.
Your era.
Yeah. So you arrive. And you were different than any other DJ that had been at Radio 1 up to that point.
Real shouty.
How do you feel like you were received?
Oh,
in the building.
In the building. What a good question. Wow. Annie, I've never thought about that.
Well, that's a good thing. That's a very good thing.
Yeah, because I was so obsessed with how the audience were taking it, you know. And I also assume, well, you know, you've waited around for me long enough. I guess you're happy to have me. But in the building, I think within the staff, the production staff, there was, as you say, there was a sense of like fresh blood, something new, something exciting. I think some of the DJs were probably a bit weary. But I think, and you know this, DJs are weary.
DJs are wary.
We're wary types.
We're wary. You know, well, because our jobs are consistently precarious, especially unless you've, you know, you're in where your situation where you kind of, you know, you run the show. Like, you are literally like a pawn in a game of chess by your bosses, and you can go and be moved at any point. So, yeah, you have a right to be wary, I think.
I think so too. And I think it works for whoever is employing talent to keep talent feeling that way. I think it's a tactic. Yeah, for a time period there, I think we all played along, you know. But I mean, look, I'm a pretty easygoing person. I mean, you have to go some to really, like, long-term piss me off. And I expected that, you know. I was, like, I mean, you don't keep a job open for 8 months or whatever and not have some DJs go, like, who does this guy think he is?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So you just got to ride that out.
But also, I think it was a lot, you know, that wariness was a lot to do with how different you were. So kind of the way that you approached presenting was a completely different perspective than traditional way of doing it, in that you came at it, like, as you said, from the performance aspect, but also from a music making aspect, where the desk wasn't just, you know, a facilitator, it was actually an instrument, and you were stood up. No one else had stood up to
that
point.
Which was hard at that point because the desks were fixed.
Yeah, so the desks were these low down, like, BBC 70s.
Do you remember how I used
desk.
To have to stand?
Yeah.
With my legs, like
akimbo.
Like, I'm like, so it was awful. It was manspreading at its worst, but it was functional. I had to, I never choice.
How did you find those first few weeks? Can you remember them?
Yeah, I can. I can remember them pretty well. I mean, I remember the 2 weeks leading up to the first show.
It was July 2003, by the way.
It was
I've done
July
my facts.
The first.
July 1st, and it was 8 p.m. and John Peel was after you at 10 p.m.
That's right. And I couldn't even get my head around that. I remember a lot of discussion about what the first song was going to be, the second song, the third song. Like, the first half an hour, we just went round in circles on, I remember. And yeah, I was terrified. I mean, I was scared. I was scared because I knew that Radio 1 had hired me to be me. So I couldn't come in and ease people in. And we even had a conversation. I don't know if you remember this, but you, me, because what we haven't established maybe is that Annie was on my team.
Yeah, I was part of your team.
Part of my team.
Yeah.
And so you, me, Rob and Joe, who were the team, we had a conversation, and I think it might have been Rob said, you know, maybe we should just kind of ease people in a little bit and like dial it back a little bit. And it was Joe who was like, nope. No, give it to him between the eyes. Go for it.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I was going to do, to be honest. Even when I put the mic out for the first time, I didn't know what version
did you not?
Of me. No, I had no idea whether I was going to, you know, go for it or lean back. And in the end, I went for it. If you listen back to that link now, Joe has played that to me before. In the past, we found an old copy of the first show, and oh my God.
Why? What's it like?
I'm just so screamy, so yelly. I sound like I'm having a nervous breakdown.
Oh, it's 8 o'clock. It's Radio 1. Let's go.
And did, we had the ECG. So this is another thing we'd spent ages crafting is the opening.
Yeah.
The intro, which was just a heartbeat,
Oh my God, how pretentious. It's so beautiful looking back
It's brilliant. And then the show ended with the flatline. And Joe told me this morning that John Peel at the time was like, oh, great that radio's dying just before my show.
Looking back, it's so disrespectful. Like, oh, we just killed the air.
I never
air.
Thought about it from that me perspective. Neither.
And we didn't because we were so self-obsessed.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were more than self-absorbed.
We were self-obsessed because we were like really, really excited. Because it, as you said, it felt like a revolution. It felt like something really new and really exciting. And it felt like we had to deliver.
And we were young.
Yes, we were young. How old were you?
Well, actually, I wasn't that
young. You were
young.
We were like 30, what?
31.
31, that's young. That
no,
is
2003,
young.
No, it's 30.
30, there you
yeah,
go.
30. Yeah. Not even, maybe 29.
Yeah.
Just about to turn 30.
Still in your 20s, yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, things tend to happen in decades for me. Like, you know, I was sort of in my 40s when I went over to LA, and
yeah.
It sort of moves in that way for me. But yeah, there was a lot of excitement at the time, and I just, from my perspective, I was like, just hang on tight, and if you can get through the first 2 weeks, you'll be okay.
Yeah.
You know, as long as you're not fired in 2 weeks, you should be okay.
Yeah. Do you look back at, I mean, you had 12 years in that slot,
yeah.
which is an entire decade and more. Do you look back at that fondly?
Of course.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, like nothing but fondly.
Mm.
You know, the fondest of memories of that time. And also, in a way, now that I've recognized how different my objectives and my job and jobs and things I have to do and I do now are so different to that. I'm really glad that I've recognized the differences because I could never have a radio job just doing a radio show that could be as good as that. Do you know what I mean? In terms of, and I'm not talking about the difference between BBC and Apple, like they're just fundamentally different, but I'm not even really referring to that. I'm referring to the time, the kind of music we were playing, how it was to have records before they were out.
Yes.
Before streaming
the
and all
good
that.
Old days.
You know what I mean? When you would hold the record and you'd be able to sort of generate the excitement and then it would come out and if it performed well, you'd get another one and you'd get to promote that one. And if that did well, you'd get another one. And that was the legacy. And so, you know, it was just a really, really good time to do that. And, you know, when I made the switch and went over to streaming, I thought I was continuing on with that idea. And I worked out within about 6 months that it was very different. It's really different.
How?
Oh, in so many ways. I mean, you know, streaming is a place where the music exists, right?
Yeah.
So
it's already there.
It's got to be. Because if we're talking about it, the artists want it to be heard by everybody, right? Because it's an accumulation business. So, you know, you want 50 million, 500 million, a billion streams. That's what you're trying to get to. And so, you know, when you're inside a streaming service, what you have to do is you have to really just connect to the conversation rather than try to own it. It's different when you're at a radio station and you still have the attention of a country or a city or a town. You're a satellite and you're a real beacon. And I've said this before, but you're a real beacon for the community and it's a very important role. And that's why radio will continue to thrive. And that's why it survived and moved past many distribution shifts and many different media shifts. It's an essential part of everyday life. But when you're in a streaming service, you know, it's moving 1,000 miles an hour all the time. And so rather than try to control everything, what you have to do is you just have to try to amplify things and contextualize things and connect to things. And, you know, I listen way more than I talk. And I used to talk a lot more than I listened.
Yeah.
You know what
and
I mean?
When you say you listen, you mean you listen to music or you listen to people?
All of it.
Artists?
All of it.
Okay, I see what you mean.
All of it. Like I listen to fans, I listen to artists, I listen to more music. I just listen.
Yeah.
And when I choose to talk, I try to be way more effective and way more decisive.
Yeah.
Whereas before, I think, God, half the shit that came out of my mouth when I would talk back in the day. But that was because my job was to talk.
Of course.
It was just to talk.
Yeah.
And now I have a lot of other jobs and radio is just one of them, you know?
The radio, okay, I want to ask you about that, about the importance of still having radio as a job.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you have considered not doing and why? And why do you have a need to keep that as part of your life? Because I can imagine it would be, you are doing so much. You're a global creative director of Apple Music.
Mm.
You don't have to be doing Beats One, but I feel like it's part of you.
This is where he reaches for a glass of water. Wow, did I just use myself in the third person? That's the worst thing I've ever...
No, it's fine.
You know what I mean? That's an excellent question. Have I thought about it before? Yes.
I have. Because it got too busy, is the short answer.
Yeah.
It just got too hectic trying to balance everything I felt I needed to do in that job and still do and commit to radio. And so what I did was I actually scaled my show down to an hour for a short time. And to free myself up more time to cross the parking lot, as I call it, because the studio's in one side of the parking lot and our offices are just on the other side. And I just missed it, man. I just missed it. And I realized that really it's at the core of what makes me want to do the other stuff. And why am I neglecting that and putting all my time into this when that's what got me here?
Mm.
That's the thing that got me over to America or got me to Radio One or got me in these places.
Yeah.
So if I'm ever going to turn my back on that, I need to be absolutely certain that whatever hole that leaves can be filled either with something as equally satisfying or that I'm willing to just close the book on it because, you know, like they've done at other points in my life, I feel good about the decision. Whereas this wasn't that. This was, I need more time, and that wasn't the reason to do it.
Mm.
So I'm now back at 2 hours, and I'm actually enjoying it as much as I've ever enjoyed it before, and in some respects more because of all the things I mentioned before, the fact that streaming is just bonkers.
Yeah.
It's just bonkers. And I love trying to catch that. Because it's moving, or it's like trying to catch a fly. It's like impossible.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just love that. I love that I'm never in front of it. I'm always chasing it.
Yeah.
I actually really, really enjoy that side of it.
Do you feel like your actual radio presentation has evolved over the years? And if so, how?
Yeah. So the Radio One...
Obviously,
was,
not radio now, streaming, but just being a DJ.
But it's cool. I made that distinction for myself, and then it sort of caught on a little bit in the press, but it's radio. There's no two ways about it. It has. Like, when I was first at Radio 1, well, XFM was just screaming, and then Radio 1 became controlled screaming.
Yeah.
And now I do less of that. And it's not that I've grown out of it or because of my age or any of that thing. I still get excited about records and I'm still totally capable of going for it. The other day I played, you know, Blood, Sweat, Sugar by Jimmy Eat World just for old time's sake and still fucking ruined the shit out of that song. I've got no problem ruining people's records. Put on Scenario by A Tribe Called Quest and I'll ruin the whole thing.
He will. That's another thing Joe said to me this morning is when you had Snow Patrol in session and you did.
We're not going there.
You did the Jay-Z rap.
Oh, man.
We did cover Beyonce.
And changed it from Jay-Z in the range to Zany in the range. I mean, that's up there with me replacing Ryan Gosling in the poster for Drive Rescore. Do you remember that one? Oh, God. That was one of the only times where I got a hammering on social media and I went home and told my wife and she was like, oh, don't listen to it, babes. It's no big deal. What'd you do anyway? And I told her and she was like, oh, you deserve everything. You're kidding. God, remind me to tell you the time.
What? Tell me the time.
I rapped Scenario with Leo DiCaprio one time drunk at an after party. That was a moment.
I bet he knew all the words.
Oh, man.
That makes me love him even more.
He started it.
No.
I got introduced to him and I didn't know what to say to him.
Yeah.
It was late night. I was at his party. I'd come up with a bunch of people, so I was plus four.
Yeah.
And I got introduced to him and I just thought, well, it's either going to be hello and goodbye or I'll say, hey, you know, I know you're super close with Tip.
Yeah.
I just started working with Tip at Beats. Mm-hmm. He's amazing. And he was like, he's one of my best friends. I love him, man. I love that guy.
Yeah.
And I thought that'd be it. And then he goes, what's your go-to Tribe lyric?
And of course you have like a stat.
Oh, I was, oh my God. I was like back in the days when I was a teenager before I had status and before I had a pager. And I waited and he just went, you could find the abstract listening to hip hop. And then for like about five minutes.
I like him brown and yellow, Puerto Rican and Haitian. Yeah, my name is Fab Tub from the Zulu Nation.
That's so good.
Yeah.
Jack off on the couch. Now you got Siemens furniture. Anyways. And then for about 5 minutes, we just kept trading lyrics. Tribe lyrics. It was a funny.
What
moment.
A moment!
It was a funny, very funny experience.
So you live in LA now for 4 or 5 years, and you made that move over to Apple. What was there a point in radio where you and I genuinely think because I'm 41 now that I had a midlife crisis last year. Mm. Now I've got the benefit of hindsight.
How did you know?
because I started looking backwards for the first time in my
Interesting.
Life.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I was started thinking, hang on.
You were reflecting on what you'd achieved and working out
I've done the same thing for 15 years. Yeah. I mean, I love it, but it's I need to learn something quick.
Mm. Oh my God, I had the same vibe.
So is that what happened to you?
You mean why I went?
Yeah, or why you had, like, why you started looking elsewhere.
Oh, well, I
Because it's not just a job, it's a whole lifestyle change, what you did.
No, my ratings went down.
Oh, right.
And my ratings never went down. They were always consistent, or they went up. And they went down, what'd you say?
You weren't used to that.
Yeah, I wasn't used to it. Well, they went down once, fine. And that happened a couple of times, but then they went down twice. And then they went down a third time.
Yeah, but that's Rager.
It's fine.
Fucking Rager.
It's fine looking back on it now, but what it made me think was, once I got over the ego bruise of it, it made me think, it made me ask the question, where are the audience going?
Yeah.
And that was the most important question I could have asked at that time. Not what could I do better, or what aren't you doing to promote my show, or any of those other things that are driven by the ego. I actually took a look at it from sort of 10,000 feet in the air and looked at it more from an analytical point of view.
Yeah.
Like, where is the audience actually going? And so on the third one, I said, look, it's fine. I know my numbers are dropping a bit. I get it. But can I ask a question? How's the rest of the UK doing at that time slot? And someone,
good question.
Yeah. Yeah. And someone came back and said, it's all down. And that was all I needed. That was it.
It's like, okay.
Well, then
it's
I
not
knew.
Just me. Well,
then
it's
I,
everyone.
Well, then I knew. I knew that things were shifting. And so for me, it was like, it wasn't that I walked, and I didn't just jump ship. Like I you know, that was 2 or 3 years before I left. The first order of business was to turn it around, which we did, you know, and get myself back onto a solid footing, because I didn't know what was around the corner or if any opportunity was coming. So I was like, you just got to make the most of what you have now.
So you tried to turn the show around?
Yeah.
So as in like launch, relaunch it, new stuff, new features?
It was even more simple than that. We just we use social media. Like, it's crazy to think about it now.
Yeah.
But there weren't many shows. Maybe you were doing it and someone else, but not many shows were actually actively driving the conversation through their social media channel back then. Not that I was aware of it, Radio 1 at least. And so we just started to connect the audience and the artist through our portal. And we'd started to notice the retweets and all those things, you know, artists liked it. And then, you know, that's content marketing. And so next thing you know, things turn around. I don't know. Maybe it was just, like you say, Rager, who knows, that thing's weird.
It's so weird.
But for me, it just, that was when it planted the seed. And not that I needed to leave, but it made me think, not dissimilar, I suppose, to what you just did, like, what is the next step? Because I just can't stay here forever. Either I'm going to get moved on, or I'm going to get bored and move myself on. And I need to get to a point, if I can help it, where I can come to that place before either of those two things happen. Because again, you just want to end things well. I just love putting a ribbon on things and knowing that that part of my life is done. And I always kind of regretted a little bit, not that I'm one for regrets, but you know, I stayed too long on Gonzo. I mean, most people listening won't even know what that show was, but it was a bit of a cult show on MTV2. A lot of bands started by watching that after school. I mean, the Monkees famously said, you know, we used to run home and watch Gonzo, and that's kind of how we all used to sort of bond over music. And we stuck around too long. We stuck around on that show too long. We should have knocked it on the head, you know, a couple of years earlier than that. I just didn't want to make that mistake again.
So you kind of knew from that. You had it.
I knew. And like I said, I got the ratings back up. And so I knew that the audience was still there. And you've proven that. And other shows have proven that, you know, that the audience still exists for the station and for what you do. But for me, it made me think. It just made me think.
Yeah.
It just made me question.
Let's talk about the ribbon that you put on it. Your last show.
Oh, man.
Okay, so
I couldn't wait for it to be over.
I was in that studio, right? Just for 1 second, look at it from my perspective, okay? So I'm taking over your slot, right? It's your last show. There's a hashtag thank you, Zane, that your producer set up. Every single fucking artist in the world has done the hashtag. We're talking Adele, like big emotional outpourings of gratitude.
I still get alerts.
Coldplay.
Harry Styles' tweet still shows up on my timeline. That guy's so
sent a pint to the studio, like everyone who
with
could
a
have
note
tweeted.
Saying we never liked you, though, to be fair.
Yeah, but that's Irish humor, obviously. Sure. But I'm sitting in the studio going, what the fuck? Like, how intimidating could do you want to be anyone else?
So can I
just, like, do you know, does anyone want to come back from the dead here? So, like, Biggie Smalls sent a message from heaven?
So can I add something to that story? At the end of my last show, there was a photo taken of everybody that had ever worked on the show. Do you know where I'm going with this?
I think so.
And in this photo is everyone who's ever touched the show. So there's and a few extras who are still there for the final song. So there's probably 10 to 15 of us in this photo, all crammed in group shot. Where am I? Right stuck at the back, top left-hand corner, almost out of frame. Where's fucking Annie Mac? Front and center in the middle of the photo with everyone surrounding you like, it's Annie's show. I was like, wow, how quickly they forget. I'll show you.
Oh my God.
It's the best photo. I remember showing Cara later that night. She was just like, well, that does it, babes. You're out.
Oh my God. I had no idea.
But did you know I had one of the worst hangovers of my life that day?
No.
I'd been out the night before with Jeff Barrow from Portishead and a mutual friend called Tom. And we were staying in a hotel because all our stuff was on a ship halfway across America, to America, I should say. So we were staying in a hotel and we went out for dinner. And then because we were staying in the hotel, we stayed in the restaurant or the bar till, I don't know, 2:30, 3 in the morning, something like that. And I didn't think at the time that I'd overcooked it.
Yeah.
But I woke up the next morning and I was just a write-off.
Oh, no.
Like really bad. Like, I don't think I can do the show bad.
Shit.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah, man. Like, I went with Cara to pick the boys up for their last day at school. Came back to the hotel. And, in fact, no, I didn't even. Cara had to go get them on her own because she had to drop me back at the hotel where I lay on the couch. And I honestly, I just wished so hard for just 45 minutes sleep. Please just let me close my eyes. And I did, and I got 45 minutes sleep almost on the dot. Yeah. And I woke up and it saved the whole day.
Oh my God.
Because before that, I couldn't string a sentence together. Well, I was very irresponsible. But I was also, I think, just kind of desperate for it to be over.
I've seen so many of these shows. I've seen it with Sarah Cox. Mm. I've seen a lot of people's last links and last shows. And it's excruciating because everyone from the station comes in absolute goodwill and stands around and stands outside the studio and inside the studio and watches. So your last link, and you've only ever spoken to the audience, suddenly you have an audience of people that you'd like know from the bloody canteen and work and stuff. And you're like, now you have to deliver. I always feel like if that was me, I'd want everyone just to fuck off.
Oh, do you know
in the nicest possible way.
Do you know I was on my 40th birthday, 33,000 feet in the air away from a party. So there was no opportunity for anything surprise.
Yeah.
I booked it deliberately in case there was a surprise.
Yeah.
We're out.
Yeah.
I mean, I did such a good job of avoiding my 40th birthday. My wife and kids forgot to wish me happy birthday on my birthday for 2 hours until I had to remind them, you know, it's my birthday, right? No, I couldn't wait for it to be over. I was, you know, and it wasn't that I wasn't grateful. And I wasn't thankful and I wasn't emotional like everybody else. But you're right. I mean, anybody would feel that. And then you factor in my levels of anxiety and my OCD and how socially awkward I can be. Mm. And you put that in there. It was a lot. But, you know, people still talk about that show like it was great. So I think, you know, we did it. We did the damn thing. I played
you
the records
I held
it
down really well.
Yeah. And then I went and got even more drunk.
Yeah. And your last record was?
Queens of the Stone Age.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. That band has always kind of bookended things.
Joe Harland, again, our mutual friend, told me today that the first time I ever spoke to you, I was pretending to be a competition entrant.
That's
on
right.
Your pilot.
On the pilot. Number one.
In order to win a hypothetical session with Queens of Stone Age personal tattoo artist.
Do you remember
I had no recollection.
Wow. Hypotheticals, remember those?
Yeah. Hey, do you remember calling me after I got the show? Or before you left for LA?
Yeah.
You called me and it was really, really, really lovely. Because you wish me super well. And you gave me amazing advice, which was just be you, which sounds like the most obvious thing in the world. But
I listened to your first show. My hotel. We went away to the beach for a couple of days up in Cornwall and came back. And we had 1 or 2 days, I think, to kick it in London before we flew on the Tuesday. And so on the Monday night was our last night in London. And I tuned in and I listened on Monday.
Mm.
Yeah. What did you start with? You started with a
Giant Peach, Wolf Alice.
Wolf Alice.
Yeah.
I remember.
Yeah.
It sounded great.
Yeah.
You know, I listened to the first hour or so and then...
Wasn't it weird though? Because when I've listened to other people do my show, well, it took me about 2 years to start calling it my show and not call it Zane's show. But even when I go on maternity leave and stuff and people do it, I find it very difficult.
Yeah, I never liked having dips either, but I liked having holidays more, so I was totally fine with it.
Yeah.
was it weird? Of course, yeah, it was weird. It was weird because I had an evening on a Monday. Mm. So I was like, and I liked that. I liked that. I was like, yeah. I could get used to this.
Yeah.
So that was cool. But you know what? It was weirder waiting for it to start. Mm. It was weird. The anticipation of you coming on was weird because I felt nervous for you and detached from my perspective. But then once you started and Wolf Alice played and I knew you were in your groove and you were just being you and you were, you know, as good as you've always been, I felt good. I felt calm. In fact, I actually distinctly remember saying to Kara and Seth, who was with us, Seth and Rach, you know, family and their kids were with us, you know them. And I said, I feel good. This is right. This feels like the right show and the right person to do it. And it's not even like I have a say. It's not even like I'm invested anymore in it. Once you leave, you got to leave. But emotionally, I still was. I wanted it to be great. I wanted you to be happy.
12 years of your life.
Yeah, and I wanted the slot to continue. And I knew already at that point, because we were thinking about what Beats One was going to be, I knew I wasn't going to put my show in that slot.
Yeah.
So I kind of wanted it to continue and to build on what we'd done. If you've been lucky enough to ever help sort of have a piece, be it big or small, of anything for a period of time, then, and you hand it over, then the worst thing you could do is hope that it fails.
Mm.
You know, you want it to continue.
Mm.
I mean, it's kind of meaningless if it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
It only means something to you, and that's not good enough.
Zane, what is the, what's the next 10 years going to look like for you? Are you one of those people that have the plans out, that plans forward, like has a kind of rough manifesto in your head of how you want your life to be?
Yeah, it tends to happen around the same time. Once I got a handle on what it is I'm doing, then I start to think about what I can sort of add on or what new challenges I can take on. I simultaneously, though, in parallel, I never really think about big, substantial moves until I've done the damn thing.
Okay.
Like if I've done the damn thing, then I'm ready for change. That's cool. But while I'm doing the damn thing, I'm always looking to amend and improve and add on. And so, you know, 4 odd years in this job and, you know, I have a new job, you know. Yeah,
which is the global creative director?
It's global creative director. There's two of us, me and Larry Jackson. We're partners basically in the relations side of things, which is, you know, he and I have built our respective teams to just work really closely with artists and managers in the creative and then just we try to feed Apple Music with as much of that as possible so that we can get ahead of the business and be prepared and create really meaningful collaborations and creative opportunities for artists and streaming, right? It's something we're really passionate about because we recognize that streaming is such an effective and functional distribution of music that can be forgotten about.
Mm.
And so, you know, Larry was taught, I mean, he's had the mentors.
Mm.
He worked with Clive Davis, but he also worked with Jimmy for years. And I worked with Jimmy, and what Jimmy really sort of, what he really taught me and Larry is that, you know, artist comes first.
Mm.
And I always felt that way, but he taught me from his perspective, which gave me a lot more. I mean, I learned a lot from him. I still do. And so when I came to Apple, we were so artist-driven and artist-focused, and that kind of Beats One was the you know, the primary lane through which all of that traveled, and we decided that Apple Music, it could benefit now. It's time to build an actual department around that. So there's that. But then I'm also kind of across the radio things, make sure it's creatively done. And then I'm also traveling all around the world trying to interview these artists who don't travel because it's a seller's market and they don't need to. And you got to go to – sorry, mate. You want to go talk to Justin Vernon, you should go to Wisconsin. So, you know, and then there's the radio show. So there's just a lot of stuff. So, yeah, I am thinking about what the next steps are going to be. And I've got some cool ideas. You know, I've got – great management outside of Apple that works in parallel with what I do at Apple, which is cool. Really smart, like super, super good company. I'm with Irving and his company's amazing.
Yeah.
And
it's funny what you do, because no one's ever done, like, in that you come from an artist perspective, then you're working as a presenter, and then going into that business kind of more kind of corporate, even though it's not corporate, but it sounds.
No, Apple's like a corporation. Yeah, it's okay. Yeah.
But like, it's kind of, it's a funny amount of hats that you wear.
It's strange, right?
Right?
Yeah, it is. And on a bad day, it seems like I'm not wearing any of them right.
Yeah.
You know? But on a good day, I feel like I'm learning more every day than I ever have before. Mm. And I think that the only thing that I don't really have time for that I immediately am starting to make a little more time for is getting back in the studio space.
Okay, I was going to ask you about that. Because like, you did a lot of that.
I did, and that was really starting to pick up momentum when Apple called. It's just funny how this always works for me. I mean, at two or three times in my life, I'm faced with this question, you know, which one are you going to choose? And the rest of the time, I strike a balance between the two. But at some point, you got to make that decision, right? Mm. And so I made a decision to go in and continue to do this thing because I felt the opportunity was too great and the learning was going to be too great. So I'm starting to kind of get back in that space a little bit more. I had my first session actually the other day, which was super fun.
No way.
Yeah, with Tom Morello. That was
wow. Really,
I don't know if I should say that. Who cares? Wow. Tom won't care.
And wow. How exciting.
That was really cool. And just, I don't know, man. I mean, that's an easy add-on for me if I can find the time to do it because it feeds my soul.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm going out there and developing a new business strand. I mean, you can talk. You've got like, your empire's nuts. Like, how many festivals do you have now? Five?
Oh,
no. You've got Malta.
Yeah, you've got this London thing.
You've got the London thing, the Jazz Cafe thing.
Yeah.
And then something else brewing, I'm sure.
There's something else brewing.
You know? Mm. And I mean, I already know. I mean, you, like, I admire your hustle. Like, you absolutely.
But I'm feeling the same in as you in that I find that really creatively stimulating. Sorry, really stimulating, and I'm learning. But creatively, I don't feel fed, and so I've been like
because you know you've become a businesswoman,
and I never intended to do that,
and I never intended to be.
It's
a business
funny,
man.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Like, but I think you know if you learn enough, and look, I think it's okay, I think it's a good thing that people like us are in situations we're in because we're coming in with the artist in mind and we're coming in with the fan in mind because we're both fans. Mm. So we want to create the best experience, whether it's your festival or it's my, you know, whatever I'm doing in streaming. We want to create an environment that super serves those two things, which is the artist and the fan, of which you're both and of which I'm both. So it's good. And I think that's one of the positive things about the entertainment industry right now is that, you know, there are more people who are artist orientated or artists themselves stepping into more controlling positions. Mm. And I, you know, I love that side of it. And that's one of the things I'm really proud of at Beats is we gave the artists so much of the real estate to control themselves, you know. Yeah, yeah. And that's really worked. Like that's still, like we have five shows coming out in the next 3 months that are really good. And that phone still rings.
And that must be a lovely part of your job.
Yeah.
Going to artists and saying, hey, I want to give you a platform where you can do whatever you want, play whatever you want. Take it.
That is the fun part. The not so fun part is when they get angry or upset and then you have to take an angry call from an artist because, you know, I'm not used to that. I'm used to just being the good guy.
Yeah, of course.
So sometimes you have to sort of like, and also as we know, you know, the artistic spirit can move the needle both ways.
Yes. very diplomatic way of saying that.
You know, I mean, they can, you know, it can be a unique conversation.
Mm.
But that's what makes it exciting and great.
Mm.
And that's why we do it, is to put ourselves in the middle of this really magic process.
Mm.
And it's the thing that ultimately has always moved me from the minute I first picked up a record and looked at the back cover, which was Tom Petty and was produced by Jimmy Iovine.
Fuck!
Isn't that mad?
Isn't that mad? Does Jimmy inspire you when you look at him in terms of his production credits? Does he still produce or he's kind of made that
Not that I'm aware of.
Now.
Not that anyone's aware of. I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't know if he has or hasn't recently, but does he inspire me? Oh my God. I mean, infinitely. And it's funny because when he sent me a really early edit of Defiant Ones before it had come out. You've seen it?
I have seen, of course.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah.
And he sent me a text like, what'd you think? And I was like, Jimmy, it's like the greatest.
Mm.
It's the greatest. Mm. Like, congratulations. Like, your life's ahead.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Your final, if this is your last kind of big hit in terms of the music business, it's your life.
Yeah.
Congrats.
Yeah.
And he came back and I didn't say that, but you know what I mean? And he came back and he was like, what did you take from it? And I said that I don't work nearly hard enough. And that's really the thing that I'm constantly in awe of is that no matter how many hours I put into what I'm doing, or no matter how much mental time or, you know, investment of time or energy I'm putting into something, that, you know, I've worked for some of the most impressive people in the world and in the industry I'm most passionate about, and I may never get to that level, but it inspires me to try.
Mm.
And, you know, he works so hard, which is amazing because he never needed to, I don't think. He always says he did, but his instincts are so sharp, it's ridiculous. Like, that guy can, you know, see around so many corners, he's almost looking at his own back.
Wow.
It's crazy. So, I mean, yeah, I've learned a lot from him. I was very fortunate to get that time with him before he decided to go on and try new things. And he still consults with us, but you know what I mean? In terms of like every day, people always ask, is Jimmy in the office? Like every day.
Mm.
And, you know, I'd get this, like someone would come up and go, oh, you know, Jimmy wants to see you. I'd be like, wicked.
Yeah.
What's he got?
Yeah.
What am I walking into?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Come on, man. We've got 10 more minutes. What else you got?
You're a dream to interview.
What else you got?
Imagine that. Imagine you being like...
I used to hate that.
Did you hate being interviewed?
Oh, I used to hate it.
Why?
Oh, my God. Because I never felt like I had anything to say, you know? And it was only until I got a certain point in my life where I think I'd done enough things that were sort of quote-unquote potentially interesting. And also, once I acknowledged that I was flawed, that I realized that I had, you know, anxiety.
Yeah.
And had bouts of depression and had OCD and these things. Once I acknowledged those things and came out the other side of that, I realized, oh, okay, now's the time you can probably start talking about yourself because it will help you. And if that conversation ever comes, it might help somebody else.
There's nothing to hide.
Exactly. Mm. But before that, it just felt like, oh man, you know, what do I say?
Because you couldn't be honest?
No, because I just didn't feel interesting.
Okay.
You know, I think that's part of the reason why I've always invested in the conversation with somebody else is I think other people are more interesting.
How do you approach those, like the big interviews? I remember going into a studio after your Kanye interview and speaking to you and your producer, and you were just like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like, how do you mentally prepare for an interview with an artist of that caliber?
Of that caliber?
Yeah.
Well.
Because you've done the greats.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
I was saying to someone today, I think I've probably reached my 10,000 hours now in terms of the amount of time I've spent interviewing people. That's crazy, right?
But how much time do you prepare?
Well, it depends. Like, if it's live and it's someone I know, not very much. I listen to the music. That's the absolute must courtesy. You know, I gotta know what I'm talking about. I've gotta know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But I try to keep it as kind of, at this point in my life, excluding the ones you're talking about, which we'll get to, I like the idea of live talk even more than promo talk. Like, this is interesting to me because we're learning something about each other and we're reminiscing in a lifetime kind of way. You know, I've done enough promo interviews, man. I've done enough hawking records. You know what I mean? Like, for me now, it's like, yeah, we'll give you the chance to tell people your music streaming. But man, I do live interviews with artists all the time. We don't even mention it. Like, I talked to King Princess the other day, who I know you know, who's just the charismatron. And she just is incredible. And I don't think we talked about music once.
That's like, the dream.
Like, maybe for like 5 minutes in an hour, and the rest of it was just talking about everything else. And so I'm just getting into the curiosity of life now because I've done so much talking about music. I'm fine to apply it, and I love playing it, and I love listening to it. But when it comes to talking, I'd rather talk about stuff and make music the thread that flows through it rather than the whole point. That being said, if you're going to sit down and talk to Ye, then you should probably be prepared. Not that that helped me on that particular day.
Yeah.
But the way I prepare for those ones is I write out an imaginary conversation.
No way.
Of questions. All
so
the way
with
down.
Retorts. With the,
no, I don't go that far, but I write out the question. I brainstorm questions blah, 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 for as long as I feel inspired, and then I put them in an order of how I think the conversation should run. And then I categorize them into groups, and then I memorize the categories. So there might be 6, there might be 10, there might be 12 categories. You know, relocation, I'm making this up, travel, marriage, whatever the subject matters I want to cover are. And then I go in with the footprint in my head. And then I write down the categories a few times to commit them to memories. How I used to study, because I used to cram.
Yeah.
And then I go in, and then I just try to follow the conversation with the knowledge that it's in my head. And then if I get stuck, it's there. I can draw on it, but I don't want to necessarily have it. Except for Tom York. I had the questions beside me for Tom York.
Okay.
Because I was so scared.
Yeah, yeah. What's been your worst... What's been your worst memory of an interview? Oh my God, Zane is now rubbing his face like he's traumatized. Have I brought back some some badness?
Oh man.
Come on. So there clearly is one? Or are you trying to think?
There's a few. I mean,
if you could like choose.
It's hard. Like, what I used to tell the story all the time about when I interviewed Grindr Man, how they asked the producer who was sitting behind me if he could replace me and he could ask the questions and I would go and sit at the back of the room. That was rough.
Oh my God.
But I used to tell that story like it was like, you know, a funny anecdote. But I love Nick Cave. Mm. And I admire him so much as an artist and as a human that I don't like throwing that story out now like it's like the default bad interview answer.
Mm.
And I'm glad I'm actually saying this because why should he like me? There's no guarantee that's going to happen. It's not his job to like me. It's his job to make music. It's my job to try to make him feel inspired by my questions. And I got it wrong. I got it wrong. And I just really admire him. So, you know, I've stopped telling that story like it's the thing. Like, yeah, it was a bad interview. Mm. You have them.
Mm.
It happens. You know, I had some terrible interviews with Blur. Now, Damon Albarn's one of my favorite people on the planet.
Mm.
But when I used to interview them, they were terrible. But I mean, so what? Like, I mean, I'm lucky. I've had so many more good ones than bad ones.
Talking about
what's
that,
your worst?
That Crystal Castles. Before they split up.
Oh, man. I mean,
it wasn't so great.
Yeah.
There was long silences.
Yeah.
I mean, I've kind of had to learn over the years. I've only been doing, I nearly said your show, this show.
Stop saying it now.
Since 2015, right? Yeah. So it's only been 4 years since I've been doing this multi-format, interviewing this. And I've learned so much and I'm still learning about interviewing.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing I'm trying to learn and still like get over is the idea of people having to like you. Because you can't help your ego wanting to be liked.
Of course.
You can't help wanting them to leave and think, she's all right. Isn't
I got this advice when I first started when I was in New Zealand working at a free-to-air music channel, and an old friend of mine said to me, who'd been in broadcasting way longer than I have and he was older than I was, and he said to me, let me give you a few bits of really key advice. And one of them was, try to never let your self-esteem rest on the affections of your subject because it's a job.
Mm.
And just try. And I know you're a fanboy, but it's just try not to. And so I try to hold on to that. I mean, obviously you can't always. I mean, I still get giddy. I still get giddy when I see Jay-Z. Last time I saw him was at a Roc Nation party and I nearly pissed my pants. So I still, you know, I still get nervous. I still get, I mean, I literally, I had before the Tom interview this year, I had no sleep. The jet lag was so bad. I was like, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. And he was so amazing and accommodating and beautiful and funny and charming that I literally skipped out of that pub. Like, I was like, dum-de-doo. I was like saying hi to people in the street, like, hey, you have a great day. Like, so I'm still totally capable of having my mood completely affected by that experience. It's inhuman not to.
What about asking the questions that you know they don't want to be asked?
Tough.
This is still, again, it's
tough.
I'm really bad at getting in there and just...
Me too. No, me too. Look, I mean, I'm not known for my hardball. You know, don't get me wrong. If I see an opening, I'll go in there. If I think there's an opportunity to respectfully cover ground that I think is interesting, I'll do my best to navigate it appropriately.
Mm.
But I don't ever go into an interview thinking, right, I've got my softball intro. Here's my hardball section.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just not that person. I really admire people who are. Like I'm a fan of The Breakfast Club. Like, I watch their interviews. I watch their interviews and I'm like...
That Charlemagne, man.
Well, that is the model because, look, this is what it is. And what I'm doing right now, because you can't see it, is
I constantly hold up The Breakfast Club as a model to all my bosses going, see, people are happy to have an interview that's an hour long. Sorry, it's okay.
It's okay. It's okay. I love that. Sorry, I broke your coaster, but for good reason. This is the model, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the subject.
Okay. Right, Zane's drawing a diagram, right? Yeah.
So right in the middle of the flat part of the triangle.
Yeah.
Left, right, and in front.
Yeah. Oh, you're surrounded.
You're
surrounded. There's no way out.
No. So every time you answer that one, here comes one from here, and then there's one from here, and one from here, and one from here, and there, and there, and there, and there, and there, and it's just wild.
Yeah.
And I just really, I love watching it. I love listening to it. But it's just not me. And I think one of the most important things in life is that we discover who we are, or try to continue throughout our life to continue to better discover really what our, you know, what we do and what makes us unique and what we're trying to say. And I say this to our kids all the time, me and Cara, you know, to Jackson and Lucius, you just got to continue to try and find your voice and continue to try and define who you are. It's fine to borrow and to be inspired. And as you're learning to create and, you know, it's cool, but eventually when you're faced with your own identity, don't run from it.
Yeah, and keep it. Keep hold on to it.
Yeah, hold on to it. That's an important moment in your life. And so I'm not that person. I'm like you. I don't go into it to try to deliberately catch people out. I'm not saying the Breakfast Club do, by the way, just disclaimer, FYI.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just not in my nature to do that. But, I mean, we're doing all right, you know? Mm. People come through our door, so we must be doing something right.
Mm.
And, I mean, you've had a great run. What's been your favorite since you did?
Kendrick.
Isn't
just because
great?
I felt like he was like some sort of divine deity. He felt like the closest thing I've ever come to someone who was like beyond human. That sounds so overdramatic.
No.
But his aura, his presence, his
Do you know what I
generosity, his...
I tried to describe him in the context of other human beings, which is very tough because he's such an individual. But he reminded me of like someone who's like Tupac and Bob Marley.
Mm.
Or something like he had that energy of like revolutionary, which can go either way. It can either go fight for your right, but it was also he also had this sort of super meditative, calm,
insane meditative
spiritual feeling about him.
Yeah, yeah.
So he would float through certain answers, and then other answers he'd sort of show you this look of like, but I'm a fighter.
Yeah,
like I'm a fighter.
Yeah.
So it was like a fascinating balance between the two.
And he really thinks, like he's, you know, he really takes your answer in and he turns it around, or your question, turns it around and thinks, you know, he kind of does justice to your question in that a lot of people, I don't know, I that's the thing that I found the most is that the greats are the ones who will give you the most time and respect. And
yeah, because they've got less to prove. They reach a point, it's not that they don't have anything to prove anymore, they're still ambitious and hungry, but they have more important things to prove than... you know, to try to undermine somebody in order to make their to allow their ego to feel some kind of bump of adrenaline.
Yeah.
You know, what you're dealing with at that point is that you're dealing with someone who's reached a plateau in their life where they feel confident in who they are, and the work is all that matters. And if you can get to a place where the work is really all that matters outside of family and friends, then you'll find that those people will be less difficult to deal with because they wouldn't be talking to you if they didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the place I always try to get to.
Mm.
I'm fine talking to anyone who wants to talk about their shit. I'm cool. Let's go. I'm curious.
Yeah.
But I'd rather, you know, I waited 3 years to talk to Post Malone, 2.5 years to talk to Post Malone. He doesn't talk to anybody. And when I finally got him, I knew he wanted to do it.
Yeah, which is the best scenario. Yeah.
That's what you want.
Yeah. Zane, it's 5 o'clock.
I know.
You've got to go.
It was really fun, though.
So fun.
Do you have guests on more than once?
Yeah, come back. I'll call you next time you're in London.
We'll talk about you.
Thank you. Thank you so much to Zane. What a conversation that was. So interesting and gratifying to get that time with him and learn about his perspective of that time that he had at Radio 1 and how he approaches life and work now. If you have anything to say, you know, I would love to hear from you. findinganniemack@gmail.com, or obviously just go and put a comment on the Instagram, which is AnnieMacDJ. And let's talk radio. Let's reminisce. Okay, so next week on the show is one of my favourite conversations I've done for this podcast so far, with a really esteemed and incredible woman called Suzanne Moore. I've been reading her articles for a good few years now. She writes for the Guardian newspaper, and her articles are always direct as fuck. There's no hyperbole. There's no skirting around the edges of a point. She is direct. She is super impactful. She is hugely brave and courageous in how she talks about her feelings. And that's why she's an award-winning columnist. She's also in her 60s and talks really openly about growing older as a woman. And that is what next week's episode is all about. Cannot wait for you to hear it.
I think you have to behave as though you're going to live forever, knowing that you're not. I think these two things are, you know, you keep both of them, you hold on to both of them. I remember when Derek Jarman, who I loved, he was, you know, he had his fantastic garden at Dungeness, and he was dying, you know, he had HIV, and he was dying, and he was planting stuff. And somebody said to him in an interview, what's it like planting things knowing that you might not be here to see them? Because he was very ill. And he said, everybody who plants something, nobody knows whether they're going to be there to see it, but you should do it anyway. And I thought that was kind of a brilliant, like, way to think about living, you know. And then none of us know, but we could still do the planting. Having said that, you can see I've got AstroTurf in the garden.
All right, folks, see you next week on Finding Annie for all talk about growing older. It's going to be a deep one.